The Being an Engineer podcast is a repository for industry knowledge and a tool through which engineers learn about and connect with relevant companies, technologies, people, resources, and opportunities. Enjoy the show.
You know, people will come up to you and they'll try and hand you their ball. Whatever their problem is, whatever's going on, they'll give it to you and say, "Fix this for me." And you got to give it back to them and say, "How can I help you fix it?"
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Being an Engineer podcast. Our guest today is Martha Ganesh, who holds a degree in mechanical engineering as well as an MBA. Much of Martha's career has been spent in an R&D role, and she currently serves as the Director of Operations at Scientia Vascular. Martha, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Martha, tell us, what was it about engineering that first intrigued you? Why did you decide to pursue a career in engineering?
Well, I actually started college as a social work major, and I decided that I didn't actually like to listen to people's feelings. So I tried to find a degree that was as far away from feelings as I could get. And I was working in the math lab trying to pass remedial math, and all of the tutors were engineering students, and they were building a giant trebuchet to throw pumpkins. And I thought, that sounds way better than what I'm doing.
That does sound really cool.
Yep.
And engineering seems like a good field to avoid feelings. I can't say that I have had many, you know, heart-to-heart emotional conversations with my team.
You know, I thought that too, and then I made the poor life choice of moving into operations, and it's full of feelings. And
so, oh, interesting.
But I actually quite like running the business, but there are definitely feelings, and so I'm often grateful for that little bit of experience I had with social work. I almost use it more now than the engineering principles.
Yeah, tell me more about that. So you're the director of operations at a medical device company. How have you seen feelings come into play?
Well, I manage all of the production people as well as all the manufacturing engineering resources, and all of the production people definitely are not skilled in the way of data processing or analytics, and so they often feel like their feelings have been hurt, or someone said something mean, or the world is not fair. And I think especially during this pandemic, there's been lots of feelings about continuing to work in a manufacturing environment.
That is a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah.
How have you dealt with this? Do you have any, you know, best practices, or what has worked for you to help put at ease their concerns?
Yeah, so I think that spending that time and making sure you have those hard conversations and talking about how the world is changing and what we're doing about it. I think we've pivoted really quickly and, you know, spread people out and increased the air exchanges in our clean room. And so telling people what you're doing behind the scenes to ensure their safety has really gone a long way to supporting them.
Huh. What do you say to me when I come up to you and say, "Martha, this is just not fair. This situation I'm in, this role that you've given me, it's not fair. Fix it for me." What do you say?
Well, typically I start with that life is not fair, and let's look at it from a different perspective. And my boss had the best analogy. He said, you know, people will come up to you and they'll try and hand you their ball. Whatever their problem is, whatever's going on, they'll give it to you and say, "Fix this for me." And you got to give it back to them and say, "How can I help you fix it?"
That sounds very wise.
Yes, it is. But also challenging. It's much easier to have somebody emotionally come in your office and say, "Here's how I'm going to fix this for you," where really sometimes it's not a fixable problem and we need to look at it from a different perspective.
Yeah, yeah. How can you teach a man to fish instead of giving him or her a fish?
Yes.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about your R&D days, because you spent a lot of time in R&D before you were director of operations. What's on your checklist for starting a new R&D project? You know, what is that kind of mental checklist? Or I don't know, maybe it's a physical checklist that you go through as an engineer.
Sure. So interestingly, my time in R&D was actually spent not designing things. So what I was hired to do was to speed up the development process. And to do that, they would partner me with sort of the idea person, and I would help organize their thoughts and organize their project so that it could transfer into manufacturing, and really overlaying those two activities at the same time. And so what I would recommend for an R&D project is to understand the scope, to even pause long enough to try and put it down on paper and regurgitate it back to the business. Like, you want me to make this, or this is the problem I'm trying to solve. Because so often I think people are 2 or 3 miles down the road before they go back and see what the scope actually was. Because I think most people will find that marketing and R&D have very different ideas, and the R&D interpretation of the marketing idea is rather different usually.
And how do you confirm that R&D's idea of the goal aligns with marketing's version of that goal? What are the tools you use to do that?
I think that early and often communication and radical transparency, like being able to say to the marketing person, this is what I am working on, and be totally open to them saying, that's totally wrong. That's a ridiculous idea. Like, I think there's a little bit of vulnerability in there that you have to be okay with.
Yeah. Do you, to have these conversations, have you had any formal structures in place, like the daily stand-up, or are there, you know, formal documents that clearly say this is the goal for the project, or is it more just a casual conversation that you have in the hallway?
I think having a formal scope document that someone has to sign gives you a great frame of reference, because I think engineers also suffer from scope creep and scope change. And if it's never been written down and no one signed off on it, it's super easy for the business to come say, hey, can you add these 8 more configurations? And you say, sure, I can do it. But you need to say back to the business, and this is how much longer it'll take. Mm. This is how much more money I need.
It's yes, I can do it. And right?
Yep, always and. Yes, and, or yes, but.
Yes, but that's another one of my favorites. Yes, but. Yeah, but. Yes, but. Okay. One of the things that I have struggled with managing R&D projects specifically is estimating, not so much, well, yeah, it is estimating the cost for an R&D project, right? When it's just not really clear how to get from A to Z. But then also, and even to a greater extent, understanding how far through the process we actually are at any given point, right? I can look at the budget and say, okay, we're 50% through the budget. Are sure. we actually halfway done with the project? Have you found any tools or strategies to manage that any better?
Yes. So with junior engineers that work for me, I actually have them start doing that on projects that don't necessarily have defined budgets or defined timelines, and really use those early projects to sort of polish up their crystal ball. So in a project that doesn't have a timeline and doesn't have a budget, have them estimate one, have them track to a timeline, so that when they are missing it, they can sort of recalibrate what these different phase gates they're walking through look like.
I had a question, a follow-up on that, and then I just lost it. It's going to come to me.
For junior engineers?
No, not for junior engineers. Well, it'll come to me later at some point. I know what it was. It wasn't a question. It was more of a comment. So it sounds like what you're saying is, it's really, it comes down to experience. You know, having gone through some of these projects without well-defined budgets or well-defined schedules, and just seeing what happens a few times, at that point you begin to have the experience to say, okay, well, we don't know exactly how to get from A to Z, but I think it's going to cost this much, and I think it's going to take about this long.
Yeah, and so I think it's important for junior engineers to see early on how wrong they consistently are, because everybody thinks their project will be faster and cheaper than anybody else's before, and it just never is true ever.
I agree with that. I wonder, do you have any rules of thumb where maybe you've been asked to estimate the cost of a project, be it R&D or not, and is there a rule of thumb where you do your best of estimating, I think it's going to, you know, take this long and cost this much. That's what I think, but I don't know what I don't know. So I'm going to tell, you know, the team or management or whatever is, it's this plus 25% or anything like that.
No, I definitely don't, because I find management does that. And if you go into it presenting a higher budget, then either they'll consistently cut your budget because they know you're fluffy, or so I go, and I really try to look at it. I think everyone's really great at estimating the next thing they have to do, but not so great at looking at the entire project and all of the different activities. Like the space I've played in, transfer to manufacturing, is a really, really easy one to overlook. Like, you don't order enough raw materials, you don't consider enough time for process development. And so really, you know, taking a couple days to step through what a full project plan would look like, I think, and especially looking outside of your expertise, helps develop a better project schedule and budget. Because usually people aren't doing something that hasn't been done before, and people just aren't asking what the other experiences have been.
That's a good point there. Something I found that good engineering is often, like many things in life, it often a result of asking good questions. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a broad question, but are there any standard or default questions that you like to ask yourself during the R&D process?
I think I like to talk to everyone. I think that it's super easy to go to the project leader and get the high fluffy answers, but I like to go to the people that will be doing the work and spend the time with them and understand the scope of their work.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever experienced this, but something I experience on occasion is I'll get into the details of a project and I'll be trying to solve something. You know, maybe mm-hmm. it's a design problem, maybe it's a business problem, but I'll be trying to solve something and I'll notice that my mind is going back and forth between option one and option two and option 3.4, and it becomes kind of a chaotic mess in my mind where I'm bouncing around a lot between different options or ideas, but I'm not actually getting anything done. And I've come up with this process for myself to get out of that mindset, where it's a four-step process. It's number one is identify the chaos, right? That mindset where you're bouncing around, but you're not actually getting anything done. You're not progressing. So that's number one, identify the chaos. And then number two is clarify the goal. And I like to write it out, because I feel like if you can't write out your goal clearly in a sentence or two, then you don't really understand what your goal is. And you certainly can't communicate it to someone else.
And then how do you know if you've met it or not?
Exactly, right. How do you measure success if you don't have a clearly defined goal? So that's number two. Number three for me is take some kind of action, even if it might not be the right action. Do something. And I find that even if it turns out to not be the right thing, just the act of doing something triggers processes in your mind that lead to the right thing, you know?
Sure.
And then fourth is ask for help soon. You know, if you're really just not getting anywhere, don't keep spinning your wheels. Ask someone else for help. And this is Aaron's four-step process to productivity here. I found that to be really helpful for me. But do you ever get into that? I wonder if this, you know, it's a really rare thing that happens with me where I'm this mental chaos, or if that happens often with others.
No, I think I'm pretty decisive. And I think that what I would want to encourage the other engineers to do is that step you were talking about where you need to take some action. Often people will add cost or add complexity for the sake of doing something. And I would like to encourage people to try and go the other way. Try to take whatever it is you've done and simplify it. And I think that getting to something that both meets the design intent, but then is manufacturable, makes it so that you can actually sell it.
Are you saying that when a tough challenge arises, it's easier maybe to implement a costly solution because it's maybe the first solution that comes to you?
Sure.
Whereas if you were to spend a little bit longer, you might come to a better solution that isn't costly, even though it's going to take you a little bit longer to find that solution.
More like when you're stuck, to see if moving forward you can simplify what your last idea was that didn't work. Maybe like with coding, how you can write this really long, complex code, but when you can get it down to just those few beautiful lines, that it's better than whatever that complicator you sent it through was.
Sure, yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't know when good is good enough.
That's a big point. Yes.
Yeah, I think people always want to make it better and swoopier, and it's your design, so it's got to be the sexiest, but it definitely doesn't.
Yeah, at a certain point, and that point I think is more often than not earlier than we think, done is better than perfect.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. How has diversity, if at all, help your teams in the past solve hard problems or maybe generate new ideas that a less diverse team may not have identified?
Yeah, I think as being one of the diversity candidates that is typically on a team, I think that just having this completely different view of having, like, solving a problem is really, really valuable. And so I'll try and get as many different answers as possible from as many different sources, because people think really, really differently. And it's really beautiful to see how the same problem can be solved so many different ways. And so having diversity on a team, especially engineers and not engineers, and, you know, people of different ethnic backgrounds, really helps skin the cat a different way.
Yeah, I had an experience recently where our team was trying to find a way to organize really small diameter fibers or filaments. And we had all kind of brainstormed and thought, okay, we could try this or we could try that. And we pulled in another team member who has a background in genetics, actually. Mm. And he was going into the field of genetics before he ever decided that maybe engineering would be interesting. And he started brainstorming and came up with this idea of a centrifuge to spin these fibers. And I don't know if it's going to work or not. We're looking into it. But it was such an interesting idea and one that none of us had come up with. And just the fact that he had this more diverse background than the cluster of engineers who all had the same background, that was really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say on the operations side, asking the production person that does essentially that for 10 hours a day is very valuable. Even though they don't have an engineering background, they can bring that practical piece into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I found that building something to test quickly can be very helpful in the early stages of an R&D or design project. 3D printing is fantastic for this because it's relatively quick and relatively inexpensive. Can you think of, are there other quick and dirty benchtop prototyping tools that your teams have used in the past that have been pretty useful?
I think even just having an area where you have the base raw materials and you can glue things together is incredibly valuable. And I think I would encourage people not to be afraid to fail, because you learn more from that than whatever perfect thing you perfectly made. Like, just try.
Do something.
Yep, just do something and then know when it's good enough.
Yeah. You talked about those base materials. What would you consider the base materials for a little R&D lab?
You know, it depends on the application. Prior to this, when I was at BD Medical, it would be having all of the different tubes and lures that you'd be gluing together, and you'd be able to come up with a new catheter idea pretty quickly. But here at Scientia, we make neurovascular guide wires, and that toolbox is radically different. It's very small wires with very small components. Okay. So making sure you have enough of those to create with, I think, is really important.
Yeah, we have Legos and we have clay and we have cardboard and PVC pipe and wood and
wow. What do you make? 20...
I'm sorry?
What are you prototyping? What do you make?
Oh, well, that is just, I promise everyone, I didn't even plan this, but that's a perfect segue. Why don't I take just a couple seconds right now and share with everyone that testfixturedesign.com is where you can learn more about how Pipeline helps medical device engineering teams. And we develop custom test fixtures and automated equipment. So it might be some kind of adapter for an Instron load cell. It might be a cycle test machine. It might be an automated inspection station or an assembly jig or some piece of production equipment. But that's what we work on.
So if I needed something like that, this is not planned either. Would I just go to the website?
We can talk after the show. How about that? Okay. I know someone that you can talk to.
Great.
Oh, how funny.
Is his name okay. Aaron?
All right. Well, Martha, can you think of and share maybe one big success and one big failure that you've had in your career and what you learned from each of those?
Oh, I think on the success side, I would encourage people that it's not often fast, that sometimes you can look back after 3 years of selling a new design that you fought hard for that suddenly has sold $60 million that year and saved thousands of lives. I would consider that a pretty huge success that in the moment did not feel like a success. It felt like a fight and a challenge. And there's just one group in front of another group in front of another problem in front of a regulatory body. And just maybe pause and look back and see how amazing what you've done has been. And then on the failure side, I think my biggest failure came pretty early in my career and absolutely set the cadence for how carefully I check things. But what had happened is I was working at a small OEM and we were working on a new launch for Bard. And the VP of operations had come in and said, you know, I had this dream that this word was spelled wrong on this catheter. And we went and looked and sure enough,
you're kidding.
No, it was spelled wrong.
Oh my goodness.
We spelled injectable wrong. And so we'd printed it with these steel print plates. And I called up the company in Florida and asked them, you know, how much it would cost to overnight a plate. And they said that would take an act of God. And the company made me call them back and ask them what an act of God would cost. So we ended up hiring a courier in Florida who flew in the plate overnight. And we met the courier at the airport, got the new print plate and reprinted all of the launch quantities over the weekend. And I'll tell you that act of God cost about $15,000. But you know, I think intuition goes a long ways. And if something feels weird, you should go look.
Oh, that's a big point, right? Our guts are smart, I think.
Yeah. Yep. And knowing when to look at that gut instinct, like just take those few minutes and go look and see what you're feeling. Cause it could lead to a lot of time savings later. Like if you're like, oh, this joint, it just doesn't quite go tensile test it. Like go challenge it, go take a look and save all of that heartache later. Because also, too, if something really terrible doesn't happen during the development process, it means it just hasn't happened yet.
An old boss of mine told me once that to do this job well, meaning being an R&D engineer, you have to be a little paranoid. And
yeah.
I've always remembered that. I thought it was such great advice.
Yeah.
let me put you on the spot just a little bit here and ask you, can you think of a time when you wanted to give up? Because whatever you were doing was just too hard, but you didn't give up. And can you share with us why you didn't give up and kind of what you took away from that experience?
I have not ever wanted to give up, but I do tell people that if it were easy, they wouldn't need us.
So, very true.
Yeah, if it just didn't go a little sideways, it could just run. Like, these projects would be super predictable, and they would have, I don't know, one person invent stuff and another person launch stuff, and you wouldn't have to do all this iteration and this testing and make sure your suppliers are capable and your raw material supply won't explode during an earthquake. Like, it's not easy. This job is not easy. And I also tell my engineers that's why we studied spherical chickens neglecting wind resistance in school. They were trying to see if you would give up.
I speaking of school, I remember a physics class that I had. I think it was electromagnetism, and it was hard. It was one of those weeder classes, you know. And I remember sitting in the TA lab getting some help with this, and even after the TA had explained it, I just didn't get it. And I must have been maybe a sophomore in college at the time. Anyway, I got really kind of frustrated with myself, and I thought to myself, this is, engineering is really hard. I had taken a few of the engineering classes, and this one was just kicking my butt. And I remember very clearly wanting to give up. I thought, I don't know that I can do this. I may have picked the wrong major. Maybe I need to find something more simple. And then I don't know why exactly, but something in my brain switched, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to figure it out. I don't care how hard it is. I'm just going to push through it and figure it out. And I did. And I think one of the things that taught me was that successful people, not that I'm any huge success, but people who are successful, it's often a result of tenacity and perseverance more than just being really smart.
Yeah, 1,000%. I think that I read a paper once that said you should never tell your children that they're really smart because smartness has a cap. You should tell them they work really hard because you can always work harder.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, give them something that they really, truly have control over, right?
Yep.
One of the challenges that we've encountered as a team in R&D is effective communication. And I think this is probably something, you know, a lot of teams not necessarily struggle with, but look for opportunities in which they can improve. Specifically, when we have three or four engineers spooled up evaluating various early stage concepts, it can be challenging to make sure everyone on the team is aware of what the others are working on, so we don't duplicate efforts and
sure.
You know, so engineers B and C can learn from what engineer A has already learned. Do you have any strategies that you found helpful to facilitate that communication in this type of environment?
Well, I think it comes out of the management. I think that, like, I could manage all of the engineers individually, or I could get them together every week and we could talk about everybody's projects, the timelines of everything, and really just normalize transparency. I think often people are worried to say anything because they will hurt somebody else's feelings. And I think that if you just normalize that the people are separate from the projects and drive that communication much, much earlier and consistently, I think that it wouldn't be sad if engineer told engineer B what was wrong with his or her design. Like, it's just expected, and then they can correct for it. Because I think we get very hyper-focused on whatever we're working on, and we can't see how to improve it because it's our baby.
Yeah. I recently read a book called Creative Selection, Inside Apple's Design Process During the Golden Age of Steve Jobs. And it was written by this Apple programmer. And in the book, he quotes another highly regarded programmer. I can't remember his name. But this gentleman said, premature optimization is the root of all evil. And maybe he was overstating his opinion a little bit there. But the point, I think, is well taken. Something I've suggested to team members in the past is that In the early stages of development, it's not super useful to spend a lot of time on design for manufacturability and getting all the details worked out. You know, for example, adding draft to all the surfaces of an injection molded part or sure. something like that, because things are so often changing still yeah. at this early stage of the project, and detailing everything out is just a waste of time.
Yep.
The argument that I've received in response from people is that, well, it is useful to do this refinement because there's no point in designing something that can't be manufactured, and thus True. the DFM details need to be worked out to ensure that the part is manufacturable. I'm curious, where do you stand on that topic?
I think that you have to leave that creative space for people to have bad ideas, because sometimes they turn into really great ideas. And when they turn into a really great idea, we're going to steal them from your office and make them manufacturable.
Yeah.
But I think having that involvement of manufacturing really early on sort of helps weed that out. Like if someone in manufacturing is making your sort of more developed prototypes, it naturally happens. You don't have to necessarily have that conflict in that argument. But if you're at the point where you're ordering a mold, yeah, you better consider whether or not it's manufacturable, because even those prototype molds often love to make their way into manufacturing. But if you're just gluing stuff together on a benchtop or drawing something, like, yeah, don't spend that time. But if you can start as soon as you have, you know, met your scope, it improves the timelines for everyone. You shouldn't totally finalize your design and tell everyone you're done and then decide how to make it. You're just going to waste everyone's time.
Yeah, agreed.
Especially in a regulated environment. If you've done all of your regulatory submissions based off of something that's not manufacturable, you don't really have clearance.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. You recently went back to school to earn an MBA. Can you share a bit about what prompted you to do so and what you've gained by earning that MBA?
Sure. I wouldn't say I recently went back to school. I would say I recently finished. And
oh, okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes. And what I decided to do is get my MBA before it was used as a reason to exclude me from career development. And where I was in my career, I didn't really need it, but I definitely wanted the company to pay for all of it. And I found that if I took one semester a year, then I could do it without any out-of-pocket expenditure. And I ended up leaving the company before my last semester. So I had to pay for one semester, which is very sad to my financial goals. But I started early and I made the time, and I definitely appreciated getting my MBA after having so many years in industry under my belt. It made me have much more context to some of the work than some of the other students. But I was trying to prevent there any reason for not being promoted to the next position when I was ready to be promoted to the next position.
You were building capacity in yourself.
Yeah. When I had the time to. I think if there was this really great job and I had applied for it and they're like, well, you don't have an MBA. And then I ruined my life for the next 18 months and got one. And then, you know, there's some other job that didn't need it. Then I just wanted it out of the way, and I wanted to do it on my terms. And so it actually took me longer to get my MBA than my engineering degree, but it was because I didn't want to pay for it.
Now, you mentioned that having the MBA allowed you to have a different or more useful context than maybe some of the team members that didn't have the MBA. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What does that mean?
I meant the other students that were in the MBA program.
Got it.
I think that the ones that jump straight from their engineering degree to work on their MBA sort of didn't have the frame of reference of what managing a multi-million-dollar project looked like. And where I had that experience and I could come in and sort of fine tune the skills I had, I wasn't learning the basics. I was polishing what I had.
Now, having the piece of paper, right, that says, I have an MBA. That's, of course, useful because,
sure,
politics are what they are in perception. Beyond just, formally being able to put that on your business card, how helpful have you found it to be, practically speaking, in your job?
I think it helped me understand some of the management things and management decisions, and definitely the accounting piece helped me understand maybe why some financial decisions would be made, and what the top line and bottom line, and why sort of companies will make these wacky decisions based off of some other influence, where, before I could just look at it from my project management engineering frame of reference and say that is a stupid plan, but there were all of these other business reasons that it helped me understand why other functions behave how they behave.
Sure. Tell me a little bit about what your day-to-day is like as director of operations. What are some of the common challenges that you have? What do you spend your time doing as director of operations?
So as director of operations, I think my biggest deliverable is the production output. So overseeing the production schedule, the production resources, and then making sure we're growing the business appropriately to meet those demands. So, foreseeing fluctuations in demand and building the equipment and hiring the people, and even the, 4 or 5 year plan of we need a new building and we need this much space. And so really understanding the business plans and making sure that we're ahead of that curve, but not so far ahead of the curve that we're wasting money. Like, it would be the easiest thing in the world to hire 50 extra people and double the raw materials, and that just puts us in a not flexible position to respond to market demands. Like, I don't know, say a pandemic comes along and one of the side effects is a stroke and you have to super scale up production. You might be scaling it in a direction that you hadn't planned. And so having that flexibility in the raw material and equipment and resources is mostly what I spend my time doing. But I'm also responsible for all of the new product introduction into manufacturing. And so making sure we have the capacity and the skill set to help R&D make their design manufacturable much sooner.
What are some tools that you wish your R&D group had that would make it easier for them to design and develop and test?
I would really like for them to be more organized. I think it's very easy to grab whatever thing off of whatever shelf and glue it together and call it a prototype. And I think that you lose track of what those things were. And so you lose a lot of time recreating the thing you already successfully made. And so maybe being more tied to a engineering notebook and just sort of jotting down things as they're going along will give you a much better frame of reference for when you think you're getting close to being done. Because I think if you're working on 5, 6, 7 prototypes and you get one that's perfect and then can't figure out what you glued together, it's not really that useful.
Right. Yeah. That's not an ideal situation.
Yeah. So take notes and clean off your workbench, for the love of God.
I can tell you, you're not speaking from experience at all right now.
No, not at all.
Well, Martha, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. It's been just delightful being able to talk to you. Before I let you go, how can people get a hold of you?
I can be reached on LinkedIn. I think that's the best way. I don't think there's many Martha Ganeshes, so I think they'll be able to find me.
Perfect. All right. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't?
Okay, I have the best interview question for engineers.
Great. Yeah.
Ask them if they've ever dug a hole.
Okay, this is already blowing my mind. Okay, I have to take a quick tangent here. I listened to a podcast with Seth Godin earlier this morning, and he was talking about creating tension and then releasing that tension in the context of telling stories and, you know, being a public speaker and captivating people's attention. You have just grabbed my attention. Ask them if they've ever dug a hole. Tell me more about that.
Well, it's not very clear. And so in the interview, you can find out if people will ask follow-up questions. Because often I'll be running around the building, I'll say something, I didn't say enough words. And so I need someone to say, I don't know what you mean. Because there's an actual physical hole and there's a metaphorical hole. And so, A, it finds people who will ask the question. Like, kind of an awkward question. But also, too, I'm looking for the answer around the physical hole, because there's some engineers who have only gone to school, and there's some engineers that have done things, and I need engineers who have done things. And so holes are never easy. There's always roots and always rocks and always sprinkler lines. And so you get to see in that one question if they'll continue to problem solve, and what was the solution and how did it go? But I did learn a couple years ago when I was scaling up a team in India that that question means nothing to engineers in India, because they hire people to dig their holes. So I had to change my answer. But I think that finding a really great interview question that actually gets to the root of what you want, the root.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. Have you left your house? Can you do anything practical? Will you ask me if I say something stupid? Like, it sort of answers all of those things pretty
quickly.
I love
it. That's terrific. Well, thank you for sharing that one. That's a gem. Martha, it's been so nice talking with you. Until next time on the Being an Engineer podcast.
Thanks.
I'm Aaron Moncur, founder of Pipeline Design and Engineering. If you liked what you heard today, please leave us a positive review. It really helps other people find the show. To learn how your engineering team can leverage our team's expertise in developing turnkey custom test fixtures, automated equipment, and product design, visit us at testfixturedesign.com. Thanks for listening.